Everyone, I'd like to welcome you to the Think Exchange podcast. I'm really excited to have the founder of Autogent here with me today, John Gauthier. John, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. So as I like to say, let's begin at the beginning. Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and your inspiration for creating Autogent?
Yeah, well, if you really want to go back to the beginning, I would say just out of college, I had gone to school, art school, Savannah College of Art and Design, to study film and sound design. And my first job was at a recording studio in Atlanta called Doppler Studios. While I was there, I got involved in audio engineering, and then I became sort of an apprentice to a very famous producer down there named Brian Michael Cox. So I was one of the many people who were trying to get on his radar and, you know, got some small jobs, work on projects and so on. But anyway, over time, what I found was this was in the, like, between 99 and 2004. What I found was the music industry was very volatile. It was changing very rapidly due to the rise of Napster and LimeWire. And this was before streaming, but the MP3 services were very disruptive in their own right. So iTunes and some of the things that were big back then. And what always fascinated me was, in my mind, the music industry at the time was very powerful. And what was startling to me was how terrified the entire industry was of this other industry, which was the tech industry. And so that led me to want to, you know, get on the other side of the table, like get into tech. And as I grew as an engineer and kind of got deeper into the industry and learned the complexities, I really found that it was challenging to, it just wasn't for me. And so I decided to quit. I left the music industry in late 2003, early 2004, not because I wasn't having success in it, because I was, but because it's just, I saw a bigger opportunity in tech. And so I spent the next few years sort of reinventing my own skill set to pursue tech and build some companies and so on. So fast forward 10 years later, I've started and exited from a few startups that I've worked on over the years. And about 2 years ago in latter part of 2014, I was thinking about how I could combine this new knowledge that I had of tech, this new knowledge that I had of data and analytics, with the old knowledge, the original knowledge I had of the music industry. And that's when I sort of stumbled upon the opportunity around Autogent.
It looks like all of the development that you've done in terms of your knowledge and in terms of your actual development of companies in the tech sector has brought you back into music to find a way to use technology to not just show the value of music and truly what it represents, but to help to grow it.
Yeah, I mean, a conversation around a new technology by, you know, suing your fans and college students, which is what was going on when I was in music the first time, right? You know, I would have friends in college who would get these cease and desist notices. And, you know, it's like there's something going on here because, I mean, it was clear that none of this was going away. It was also clear that the industry refused to change or adapt in any way to allow for these new technologies. And it's crazy. And it's also, I think what I've noticed is over the years, I run into a lot of former music folks in the tech sector. And, you know, it feels like a lot of it's not that the industry didn't get it. I think that maybe some of the executives did, and all the people who did left.
Yeah, that's who I'm
started
talking
great
about.
Companies.
Yeah. There was sort of there was an inflection point at the turn of the century in 1998 when Napster came out, and then you had other services like Kazaa, LimeWire. I mean, we could go into it for like 2 minutes of all the different permutations. But the big issue here was that you know, when there was a opportunity at the beginning to co-opt what was going on and legalize it, they didn't. And that's really what my opinion is. If there was somebody at one of the majors who was really smart enough, instead of trying to, you know, defend their turf or create their own thing for just their service, to say, okay, you know what, let's spend whatever we have to, whatever crazy internet money we have to spend on getting Napster. And I know that BMG tried to, and we could talk about that, but at the end of the day, they needed to close that deal and they needed to legitimize it at the beginning, because at that point, for at least a few years afterwards, you know, I would say until about 2004, music still had perceived value in the mind of the consumer as something that they would buy as a download or as a physical product. Now, the value to the consumer of recorded music as a product is iffy at best. Some people pay for streams, and it's got value to the consumer, but that value is, it's really more of an intangible that the, you know, it's almost like these days, if you're an artist or you're anybody who's working in the music industry, you have to figure out how do you create value beyond just the recorded product in a way that will sustain not just yourself, but sustain an industry. And that means, you know, knowing how people engage with the music, knowing how the music leads to a trigger, which can be a social media trigger, or it can be a trigger to further distribute it, or to buy a product that actually does make money, like, you know, a physical consumer product, a merchandising product, a live event product, etc. And
I was going to piggyback off that and say there was a great book that came out around the same time that we're talking about in the turn of the century, called Free by Chris Anderson, the editor of Rise Magazine.
Right.
And he talked about this back then. He talked about how, you know, the price of, you know, music as a commodity is rapidly approaching zero. So it's becoming like a loss leader for all these other things. And, you know, I think at the time, even the, you know, I don't think very many people in the music industry wanted to hear that message, but that's exactly the business model that streaming services have latched onto, right? I mean, they give all the music in the world away for free just to get those, you know, 10, 20% of their users who pay for premium subscriptions. And that works better for some services versus others, but it's created the only real model that works around digital music, you know, since MP3s, which are, you know, going through their own renaissance of trying to figure out how to retain value.
Yeah. I mean, look, at the end of the day, the bigger conversation, and, you know, you and I had a quick conversation about this last month, is really looking at what is the value of music today? Like, leave aside recorded music as a profit center. You know, there's certainly, you know, you can quantify that, and you can quantify other areas of the music industry that lead to direct sales, right? So you've got live events, you've got syncs, you've got composition, you've got tie-ins, you've got merchandising. Those are all areas where you can say, okay, there's money that's being taken in from there. And also you can say things like, you know, you can say mechanical rights and various and royalties beyond, you know, beyond just sync. But those are things that you can say, okay, these are tangible values of the music industry. And, you know, depending on who you're talking to, when you combine all of that together, it's like $18 to $20 billion worldwide. I might be underestimating it, but I'm not that far away, right? But at the end of the day, what we really have to do is say, what is the real value of music in society? Like, how does it drive CPM rates on Facebook and YouTube?
Yeah.
How does it drive engagement when music is tied into a Apple ad? How does a tour of a band correlate with the engagement that their fans have with their main sponsors? And I think that this is a sort of a lot of big thinking, right? But if you could really, you know, present something like this, it can give people an idea of just how valuable music is in terms of commerce. And, you know, I think that bringing it back to Audigent is really all about trying to show what that value is, right?
That's correct. So just to go through more of the history, around 2014, when, you know, I started thinking about this, it was prompted by an article that came out about Pharrell Williams and his song Happy. And he wrote an article, or someone wrote an article about him, saying that, you know, the streaming proceeds from, you know, like 40 million plays of that song is like $3,000 or something ridiculous. Those may not be the exact numbers, but right. I just knew it was insanely disproportionate because that was one of the most popular songs of the year.
Yeah.
And, you know, and then I was reading through, you know, some of the streaming services models, and I did some math, and, you know, I started to see that the streaming services actually aren't really, based on the traffic that they're getting and based on the way radio is priced, it seems like they actually have pretty good pricing if you were literally recreating the radio model on the internet, right? Radio, you have to make assumptions about how many people you're exposing to, because it's kind of one way. It's broadcasting, and you don't really get to measure every single person that hears a song. On the internet, you do. You know exactly every single individual. But when you put those assumed radio numbers and you take the actual streaming numbers, the pricing that the streaming services have rested on is about the same as what the publishing values are for that radio pays out to the music industry. And I thought that was interesting because at the time, the biggest argument about Spotify and Pandora and Deezer and all these services was that somehow they were ripping off the artists. And, you know, that model, quick model that I did, led me to believe that that's just not true, right? Like they, and they didn't even set the price, right? Their prices were dictated by them, by the deals they could get with the labels. And so the streaming guys aren't the bad guys. I think what it pointed to is that, you know, the market has changed. There's been a shift in the way where the value is for any artist, any entertainer, any influencer, but particularly music artists. The value has shifted from music being the asset to them and their ability to amass audiences being the asset. And so the first iterations of our product were centered around trying to figure out what that value is across all the channels that you're participating in. How much value is being created? How much of that value comes to you? And what's sort of the value of an individual member of your audience? And that led us to coming up with all sorts of new ways of deriving what that value is and making it possible for the artist to essentially have a mechanism to almost trade on that assumed value of their audience.
Right. That's really the model that has to drive a artist's career in the current day and age, because you're basically, I mean, artists will hate me saying this, but you're a commodity, right? You are an artist. Of course you're an artist, but you're a commodity, and you have to look at yourself like a product. You have to say, okay, what do I have as a product in terms of what I can present to people and how I can monetize myself, not just my music, but my presence, my name and likeness, the time that I can put into a tour, my merchandising, you know, brand tie-ins, whatever it is. And, you know, a lot of artists don't have these sorts of things, but I think that everybody has to think in that way, because if you just think, okay, I'm just going to create my songs, I'm going to get a deal, you know, that world doesn't really exist anymore. And even to the degree that it does exist, it's not anything that's going to really supplement or create a significant income for all but the highest level artists. And even those artists at the highest level, they have to think of themselves, you know, sort of, it's sort of like they have to think of themselves in the way that, like, if you look at an actor, you look at a sports entertainer, you know,
that's
a sports
exactly
star, you've got to look at yourself like that. you know, somebody who is a personality, not a artist.
Yeah, and, I mean, and I don't think the two are mutually exclusive. I mean,
right.
I think there's this idea in a lot of artists' mind that I am the artist. I must create art. And any attempt to get me to think about business makes me a sellout, right?
Right.
I just don't think that was ever true, but certainly not in the 21st century, where, you know, even the best artists, you know, have to have some understanding of what their worth is going into any sort of negotiation with a label or brand or anyone, if they want to, you know, get a fair end of the deal. If you look at, you use the example of actors. I often use the example of film directors, right? Because you can make all the films you want, but at some point, if you're not distributing, if you don't have a deal with a studio, if you aren't, you know, getting your stuff on TV, you're not making money. So, I mean, on one side, yes, you can be a pure artist, but you have to, and if you're going to be a pure artist, then you shouldn't really be worried about all of these other things. But who can afford to do that? Most people have to compromise. And I see, you know, thinking about the business world and how to leverage it so that you become more valuable of an asset is just compromising with, you know, what your needs are as an artist, which is money, and what, you know, what you have to do to survive.
Right. And, you know, when you look at it, like you said, you know, an artist needs money, and they have to figure out how they can use what they've built in order to create more money. And I think a lot of the way that they'll do that in the future is not, you know, not merely from their audience. I mean, live events will still be live events and they'll still make money. But I think artists have to look at how they can engage with people that have a lot of money, where they can create higher levels of engagement. So to me, that means advertising and brands. And, you know, when we talk about sync, we talk about, you know, all the storytelling stuff and interactive, which is, you know, mobile internet games, television and film, right? And those are all great things, I think, more in terms of an artist using that to promote themselves. I don't think that an artist, unless you're a really big artist, is going to be the thing that's going to sway somebody to go see a film, you know, unless you're starring in it. However, if an artist's music is playing in an ad, if an artist does a brand tie-in where they're a spokesperson or a brand ambassador for an ad, they don't need to be a very, very high-level artist necessarily in order to get people interested that may not be interested in that brand, who are interested in their music. And I think that at the end of the day, you know, these sorts of opportunities are going to be the opportunities that artists are going to have to look to in order to build out, you know, their profile and build out their careers.
Yeah. I mean, I totally agree. I totally agree on every level. I think it's become the norm. And something you mentioned in there, you know, a small artist might not be able to get people to go see a film. That is certainly true on one level, but on the other level, we have what we like to think of as micro influence, which
right.
You may not be able to move hundreds of thousands of people to do anything, but if you have 10 people who are YouTube stars who can get, you know, 100 people each to go, then, you know, they still become a pretty integral asset to the promotion of any film.
Without a doubt. Yeah. Without a doubt. And I think that go ahead.
Sorry, just around that. We like to think upwards and downwards around our platform. How do we this value that we're trying to assume and put in front of the artist so that they can participate with brands and with advertisers, that value is represents something for a Drake or a Taylor Swift that's as important as, you know, some unknown, you know, YouTube star or cover band or, you know, what have you. Like, our platform doesn't really care about the size of the artist. It cares about You know, how do we relate these values to the artists, irrespective of the level that they're on? How do we make it possible for them to monetize where they're at, if that makes sense?
Yeah, that definitely makes sense. How does what Audigent does serve as a tool to help them to do that better?
First thing that we assume is you can't monetize what you can't measure, right? If you don't know what's out there, if you don't know what it's worth, then you certainly aren't going to do a great job of monetizing that. So the way our product exists now is we have a dashboard. That dashboard tells you how many people are in your audience across multiple channels. So across social media, across streaming audiences, across broadcasts, and across the digital download market and retail, right? So we look at all those things. We, in total, so we're trying to give you like a 360 picture of how many people are you reaching across all these different channels. Then we give you different bits of information about the levels of engagement of those individuals across all those channels. So for instance, on streaming channels, how many people are streaming your content? How many people are watching videos? Which videos are they watching? And it's a rabbit hole of metrics and data. Also things like how much are you selling? Are you selling more? Are you making more money off your digital downloads? Or are you making more money off your streaming? And that's the type of data that we sort of present to the people who use our dash. Then the other thing that we do is we connect them almost like in a marketplace environment where brands and advertisers can discover, based on that audience data, based on the demographics of who's listening, how engaged they are, where they are, et cetera, they can see, you know, what is the makeup of a Drake audience versus a Meek Mill audience, or what's the makeup of Taylor Swift's audience versus Kelly Clarkson. And then they can make the informed decision, not just an assumption that these are all big artists and therefore we should give them all big checks. But now they can say, like, what's our expected return on investment from doing a deal with this particular influencer versus this other influencer? With a level of granular detail that you previously only got from like analyzing web traffic, right? Like Google,
right.
A lot of artists refer to our dashboard as almost Google Analytics for influencers, because it's telling you everything about who's your audience and their level of engagement in a very similar way as to what you would get on a platform like that.
Yeah, and I think that this is, you know, this is so crucial because, you know, at the end of the day, if you're somebody who's a decision maker with a checkbook and you're looking to, you know, assess who are you going to use as a brand ambassador, just as an example, you know, are you going to be best suited using, you know, Michael Bublé, or are you going to be best suited using Rihanna? And, you know, that's, and the service, that sounds really easy, right? Because they're such different artists. But what does it say? What do you know about their fan base? And what do you know about what their fan base's buying patterns are, what their demography is, where they're based in the country and in the world? And you might find at the end of the day that people that you thought were going to be in Bublé's camp are actually more in Rihanna's camp, and that she has more influence on her audience in terms of their buying decisions because they have deeper relationships with her.
That's exactly right. And this is the type of information. This is a conversation we want all artists to be able to have with the brands and the advertisers who are trying to work with them, and vice versa. Because it's incredibly hard to kind of defend your value if challenged, if you don't have any information backing it up. I mean, the biggest artist can, because there's a lot of assumptions. So if we were in a a conversation with a really big artist in their label, just happened to be at the label at the time. And there was a brand deal being done, and someone from the brand side asked, you know, someone else from the brand side, well, you know, why is it this value versus another value? And it was a really big number. And, you know, when you start getting into having to defend some of those questions, it quickly comes down to, well, this is what the artists asked for, and they're big enough to ask for it, so we have to give it to them. But right. if the artist isn't that big, you know, they get pushed down and they get, you know, they get challenged and they don't make as much money as they could. At the same time, you know, brands cannot overpay for these relationships if they don't really know what they're paying for.
Right, exactly. And, you know, a lot of the time I felt that, and I've seen it, that a lot of brands have overpaid for, you know, having a brand endorser or doing a brand campaign with somebody. Just because they're a bold-faced name doesn't mean that they're going to have the same social media impact as somebody who may be an actor or an actress who actually has a really big social media following, but they may be an up-and-comer. So, you know, all of these things are really interesting. And I guess the question I have for you is that, okay, so you can look at all of these different factors in terms of levels of engagement, socioeconomic, demographic information on a fan base of an artist. Why is it more relevant in music than it may be in sports or for actors and actresses, or is it?
Well, I would say that it's not. I mean, we have evolved to include a lot of those other types of influences, and that's particularly why I use the phrase influencer versus artist.
Right.
But there is some things that are intrinsic to music that don't exist in these other worlds. So, for instance, because of streaming and before it downloading, you can, and if you want to go way back, you also have the audience measurement companies like Nielsen and so on that essentially had to do a lot of assumptions and inferred numbers based on statistical samples. The combination of that gives you a really robust picture of what's going on around any particular artist or entertainer, right? Like you have retail numbers, you have airplay numbers, you have streaming numbers, you have downloads, and you have a lot of it in real time because of streaming. When it comes to other types of influencers, you don't necessarily have a real-time measurement like that.
Right.
With sports, you have games as they play, but that you don't know who is watching an individual player in that game, right? You know who's watching the entire game, and you know all the players who are on the field, but it's really hard to suss out like who's having the most impact on that team, and therefore who has the most value within that industry. You know, you've got the superstars, it's easy, but everybody else, it gets really difficult. And so that's one reason why music lends itself to this type of an analytic tool. I can say that, I mean, what's been most surprising about the overall trends is that you can look at the trends of any artist. So we published a white paper on this called Stream Science a few months ago. And in that white paper, we talk about being able to sort of spot the trends, the rising and falling trends of being able to maximize the value of any artist based on the stream consumption. And it's not always as obvious as more people are listening right now, therefore the artist is more valuable, because streaming happens within a bigger ecosystem that you know other factors have to be considered. Are albums being sold? Is streaming a leading indicator, or is it a post is it a trailing indicator for this particular artist? And it always comes down to the particular artist. So we haven't observed a lot of meta trends that I think I could say across the entire industry. But what I could say is that when you look at each artist in this level of detail, you can start to see patterns within their universe, within their audience, and the behavior of that audience that you can start to use to create more value and generate more revenue for that artist. And this is in, it's not always as simple as like, let's sell more tickets right now. Sometimes it might be, you know, let's not, you know, spend a lot of money on doing an advertising campaign to promote this artist over this particular period. Why not wait until the value is, because we're buying, if we're the record label,
right,
we're the management team, let's wait until the value is the lowest and then do our brand deals when the value is the highest. And, you know, this is whether you're buying your own ad networks or your own partners or somewhere else. It doesn't really matter. When you start to really dig into it, these types of trends and the ability to follow those trends is really what's at the core of that white paper.
That's really interesting. So people can get that from your website. Is it available for download and viewing?
Yeah. It's on our blog, b.autogent.com. If you just type in stream science, you'll should pop up.
Okay, that's great. That's got a lot of really great information in it. And then how does a company, how does an agency, how does a label, whoever it is, work with you? That's the first question. And then in terms of individual artists, is there an opportunity for them to work with you?
So I'll answer that last part first.
Okay.
Individual artists are on the roadmap. It's something that we're working towards. There's a number of reasons why we didn't start with them, primarily because of the complexities of dealing with lots of individuals versus dealing with big labels where we can deal with one entity and service, you know, sometimes hundreds or thousands of artists at once. So that's the only reason for that. But we are rapidly trying to expand the solution for everyone. We do work with big labels and mid-tier labels. We're always open to hearing from, you know, any label or management team that would like to speak with us. I would say the market is, or from our perspective, it's a lot easier for us to work on the brand and advertising side than it is on the artist side. And I only say that because of all the complexities of legal and publishing rights that exist on the artist side.
Seems like there would be a natural case brands and advertising firms to work with you as well as the labels and publishers and agencies and people like that.
Absolutely. Yeah. So for them, I mean, it's very much about discovering the right artists, the right influencers to partner with at a given time based on knowing everything they possibly can about those influencer audiences. That's really the value for them.
Right.
Once they know what they're getting, they can better calculate, you know, return on their investments.
Of course. That totally makes sense. Okay, cool. So what are you guys looking forward to for the year ahead? What are some of the new things that you're planning to get out the door?
Yeah. So the biggest, I guess the most exciting thing that we're working on right now is it's not really sexy. It's sort of a internal rebuild of the platform to handle scale. So that's going, you know, things are working fine. We just anticipate a lot of growth. And so we want to make sure we're prepared for that growth.
Fair enough.
The second thing I would say is more publications on the data that we're looking at. So like this one white paper was very informative for maximizing monetization strategies, what we call programmatic music marketing. The next step is to publish more of the insights and strategies that we're discovering based on the data that we're collecting and based on the knowledge that we have of all the artists that we're working with. And hopefully we can publish a case study or two, but that gets tricky because, you know, the nature of artists not wanting to reveal their proprietary information publicly.
Right. That makes sense. Cool. So that sounds great. And then if people want to engage with you or learn more, how do they do it? What's the easiest way?
Well, I'm a pretty active on social media. So we're Autogent on Instagram. We're Autogent on Twitter and Facebook as well. AUDIGENT. And we are available at autogent.com. If you'd like to reach out to me specifically, you can reach me at john at jon@autogent.com.
jon@autogent.com. Okay, that's great. Well, John, I really appreciate you taking the time with us. I think that you've given us some fascinating insights into what the real value of musicianship is as a, you know, not just in terms of streaming and merchandising, but the overall value of a musician as well as any entertainer, or as you put it, influencer, and their career, and how it can work to influence engagement and buying decisions of their fan base and consumers in general. And I thank you very much for your time, and hope to see you soon.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, and I look forward to listening to the podcast.